during that time period would only have gotten one dose of measles vaccine, given the fact that the second dose of measles vaccine was not added to the schedule until after there was a very large outbreak here in the United States in the late 80s and early 90s. So if there is an adult who's going to be traveling internationally, or if they're living in an area where there is a measles outbreak, there's no harm in getting a booster dose or a second dose of vaccine to protect yourself.
The CDC is updating their website, I think weekly at this point. Just Google CDC measles, and there's a link that specifically at the very top says cases were updated as of the specific date. So as of right now, there's been 301 confirmed cases, one confirmed death, and then one suspected death that they're looking into.
And I would add that a lot of us clinicians and anyone in health that's looking for good resources, there are some other great organizations that have excellent resources. And I'll list a couple of them off the top of my head, and Dr. Winter, Dr. Tan can add to those. But one that I'm involved with, the American Academy of Pediatrics, has some excellent resources. Immunize.org has some excellent, reliable information about things like vaccines. And then on the adult side, there are some other organizations as well. AAFP, the American Academy of Family Physicians, American College of Physicians has some information, and I'm probably missing a couple, but those are some of the resources that I say, okay, these are reliable, good resources that people can trust to give them information in this time.
Yeah, other sites would be the Infectious Disease Society of America, also the National Foundation for Infectious Diseases. They also have wonderful resources on their websites to really help individuals with information about these different diseases and the vaccines.
We heard from Dr. Tina Tan, Dr. Amy Winter, and Dr. David Higgins speaking about measles, a recent outbreak, and how communities are protecting themselves. For KBOO News, In Depth, I'm Dave Johnson.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
You're listening to KBOO's All Thrills, No Frills Volume 4 Special Programming Campaign. Check out all the great special programs we're bringing you now through April 15th at kboo.fm/ATNF4.
Support for KBOO comes from its members and from the Bay.
To you, the 9-to-5er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
Good evening, and welcome to Labor Radio, of the working class, by the working class, for the working class. I'm Jamie Partridge. Our topic is police unions and the labor movement. Our guest this evening is Christian Williams, a member of AFSCME Local 88, the Multnomah County Workers Union, and the author of Our Enemies in Blue, Police and Power in America, published in 2007. And you're about to come out with a new book, Christian. Do you want to tell us the title of that?
Yes, later this year, Policing the Progressive City will come out. It's a history of policing in Portland from colonization to the uprising in 2020.
Great. Well, thank you for joining us, Christian.
I'm happy to be here. I should probably also mention that though I'm a member of Local 88, nothing I say should be construed as representing Local 88. Really, it's only worth mentioning that I'm a member in this context so that as to signal that I'm maybe hostile to police unions, but I'm very friendly to other unions.
Great. The backdrop for tonight's discussion is the controversy in the local labor movement about whether to admit the Portland Police Association into the Northwest Oregon Labor Council, which is the AFL-CIO federation in the four counties here in the metro region. The delegate vote will be at the April meeting. Well, Christian may not be privy to all the complexities of this local controversy. He has a robust knowledge about police unions and our own Portland Police Association. So in your previous book, Christian, you point to the historical role of police in suppressing labor movements and enforcing anti-union laws, arguing that police unions are inherently at odds with the principles of the labor movement. Please explain.
Well, there are several aspects to that. Probably most obvious, of course, is the image of the cop as strike breaker, busting through picket lines, escorting scabs, that sort of thing. In the background of that, there's also a long history of police just spying on the labor movement, infiltration with red squads, and that really goes all the way back to the 1920s, and sometimes has some very serious ramifications. It was mostly the Portland police, for example, who collected the information that the federal government used to try to deport ILWU leader Harry Bridges. And a lot of people think that that's just sort of historical artifact at this point, but in the early part of this century, the Portland Joint Terrorism Task Force interfered with an organizing drive by the Carpenters Union, which led dozens of labor locals to pass resolutions urging the city of Portland to leave the terrorism task force. There are also more subtle things like we may not think of directly in a labor context, but for example, the way the police both currently and historically have enforced racial segregation is very corrosive of solidarity and tends to divide workers, make it harder for them to join together and fight the bosses. And really what all of this points to, I think, is that though the position of officers in the hierarchy of the police bureau resembles that of workers in some other sort of organization, the function that the police serve in society is really one of disciplining the working class. So their role in society is a lot more like the role of management. And that means that their social function is inherently at odds with the interests of working people. I think importantly, when police organize, they tend to organize not only to defend the interests of their members as workers, that is, against sort of the impositions of management, but they also tend to organize to defend the interests of the institution that they're a part of. So in that sense, they tend to organize police as police rather than police as workers.
Some argue that police unions, by prioritizing the interests of their members, can undermine the broader goals of the labor movement, particularly when those interests conflict with the needs of communities they're supposed to serve, such as workers' right to strike or Black people's freedom from harassment, surveillance, and violent attacks. Could you expand a little more on that?
Sure. I mean, there's a useful contrast here between unions that represent the police and unions that represent, for example, teachers or social workers, where the teachers or social workers tend to advance demands that are, in general, beneficial to the working class, that will further access to education, that will further access to social services, that will support working people in the challenges of their lives. But police tend to advance an agenda that is very contrary to the interests of the working class, that tends toward the most punitive elements of the criminal legal system, that tends towards criminalization of things like drugs or homelessness, and that is generally contrary to the well-being of people who are and the lower rungs of the social hierarchy.
Now, critics claim that police unions often shield officers from accountability, increase police violence, and obstruct efforts to reform police practices, potentially hindering progress toward a more just and equitable criminal justice system, that police unions uphold the priorities of your police departments rather than the working class as a whole. You did mention that earlier, but talk a little bit more about how the police unions shield officers from accountability, increase police violence, and obstruct efforts to reform police practices.
I mean, that's practically the reason for being. This works in a couple different ways. One is that the police unions undercut any attempts at accountability, partly by moving those away from any sort of democratic process and instead putting them into the framework of collective bargaining, which in the context of police unions, sociologists sometimes refer to as collusive bargaining. There's this trade-off where by protecting the autonomy and impunity of individual officers, the police unions, in effect, protect the autonomy of the entire institution. And what that means is that though a police chief or a mayor may from time to time try to discipline an officer and then be overruled by arbitration, what that allows is, though this has the external appearance of conflict, what it allows is for the police leadership to disavow any responsibility for what their officers are doing. So it relieves political pressure from the police chief or the mayor, who can just throw up his hands and say, well, there's nothing I can do. The arbiter overcame this. But at the same time, it means that the police then have more of a free hand to pursue the kind of agenda that, you know, their political leadership ultimately endorses. So it ends up, so the police contract ends up protecting both the individual officers from being punished by the leadership and also the leadership from political pressure from the community. The classic example of this in Portland was what's famously known as the Possum Incident. In 1981, two cops named Craig Ward and Jim Galloway left a pile of dead possums on the front porch of a Black-owned restaurant in front of numerous witnesses. Because of a public outcry, the police commissioner at the time, Charles Jordan, the first Black police commissioner, fired them both, and the police union opposed this in every respect that they could. They had a demonstration with hundreds of off-duty cops marching on City Hall. They took a vote of no confidence against Charles Jordan, which ultimately led to him being replaced as police commissioner. And they took it to arbitration, and then the arbiter overruled the discipline, instead suspended them for a while, and they returned to the force. This became a curse for not only Portland, but the entire country, because it was the legal case that set the precedent that an arbiter's ruling could overrule the discipline established by a police commissioner, who up to that point had basically carte blanche to dismiss officers as he would. This made it basically impossible to fire police, not only in Portland, but anywhere in the country.
So you mentioned that the police unions have a powerful political presence in local politics in terms of the ability of local elected officials to function. But they also, far beyond that, often support candidates and policies which unleash harsh treatment on working class people. Talk more about the role of the Portland Police Association in Portland politics, and give us some more examples.
Sure. Well, since about the 1980s, the Portland Police Association has been the endorsement that city council candidates have wanted basically more than any other. There are a couple exceptions to that. Notably, Tom Potter, former police chief, did not pursue a endorsement from the police association. I think because he was trying to position himself as a reformer and not simply as the former cop. But on the whole, it is the it's the one that is most sought after. Once candidates are in office, the Portland Police Association has exercised enormous influence, partly through its ability to turn on its members to, you know, in favor of policies that it likes and opposed to policies that it opposes, partly through its megaphone in the media. I mean, it's pretty easy for the Portland Police Association president to find a friendly journalist and give an interview in which he denounces the mayor or the city council as, you know, being soft on crime or being responsible for, you know, any number of the city's ills as the police see it. And partly they've operated through blackmail. And this has been not even a secret since the 1970s, where the Portland police kept city council members under surveillance and would sometimes come to contract negotiations with police files of the city's representatives, just as a means of intimidating them. The agenda they pursue is always on the right. It's generally, I mean, even beyond protecting the interests of its members in terms of things like wages or benefits or pensions or anything like that, it's broadly a law and order agenda, but that, you know, crosses over into a very conservative kind of social morality with things like anti-drug laws. And also, I mean, most recently, they've been very vocal in urging a police crackdown on homelessness. The predecessor to the current PPA president, Daryl Turner, described the city as a cesspool and urged the city council to give them a free hand in just, you know, pushing homeless people basically out of public view.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Labor Radio on KBOO Portland. Our guest is Christian Williams, the author of Our Enemies in Blue, Police and Power in America. If you find this information important and interesting, please consider contributing to our non-corporate, community-supported, listener-sustained radio station, KBOO, at kboo.fm. So the city of Portland is subject to a Department of Justice consent decree mandating certain measures be taken to reduce abuse and violence against people with mental illness. So what has this decree accomplished, and what has been the role of the Portland Police Association?
Well, it's had some real effect, but some very limited effect. And maybe the best evidence of how limited the effect has been is that it is that the consent decree is still in force after more than a decade. That shows that to the degree the reforms have been forthcoming, they've not yet met the Justice Department's standards. The effect that they have had is that it's changed the training in terms of how police deal with people who are in some sort of mental health crisis or under emotional distress. And that has led to a reduction in violence. I think that's certainly true. What it has not done is change the use of violence in other circumstances or lead to more accountability or, you know, and of course it was never really intended to do those things. It was very narrowly framed around the issue of mental health, which, you know, even at the time that the Justice Department began the investigation, that was objected to because it left out the obvious factor of police racism. It's true that the police disproportionately harass, hurt, arrest, etc., people with mental health problems, but that's by no means the only group that they disproportionately target. And the fact that it was so narrowly tailored meant that by design, the effect was going to be very limited. In terms of the role of the Portland Police Association, I mean, I think it's mostly been in the area of foot dragging and obstruction, just making it difficult to introduce reforms that the union opposes. even if they don't have a necessarily a contractual or a legal basis for objecting to them, they can nevertheless like just slow down the implementation until it creaks to a stop.
So the people of Portland overwhelmingly voted for a police accountability system after the wave of the Black Lives Matter protests in 2020. And here we are 5 years later. How does this police accountability system, how has it been implemented, and what has been the role of the Portland Police Association?
Well, it's only just being implemented now. I mean, they've gone about this very slowly. They established a citizens committee to create a plan for how, basically to design how the board would work and how it would be selected. And then city council did everything that they could to scale that plan back. They reduced the size of the board. They reduced its scope. They insisted on including police in the separate committee that would appoint the actual review board. And they've just in the last few weeks opened it for applications for the review board itself. So far, it's not had any effect because it hasn't yet been implemented. We'll see whether it works as intended, which would be as a truly independent body with the ability to investigate misconduct and discipline officers, or whether it becomes, you know, much like every other review board has been, the place where complaints against the police go to die. The role of the police association has been exactly the same as it's been with every previous attempt at having any sort of accountability or any sort of civilian review board, which is that they've opposed it at every step. They've fought against the ballot initiative originally. They've fought it in court since then. They tried to have subsequent ballot initiatives that would undo it. They've urged their allies in city council to undercut it. And now the president of the Portland Police Association is on the board that's going to be selecting the people to staff the review board. And one assumes that he will use his influence there in much the same way.
And you're talking about the new president of the Portland Police Association, Aaron Smouse. Am I right?
Yes, that's right.
Yeah. So bringing us to recent times, the Northwest Oregon Labor Council's Executive Secretary Treasurer, Lori Wimmer, testified against a police accountability upgrade that was proposed by Councillor Samir Kanal, which would bring the city more in line with the actual language and intent of the 2020 ballot measure. For example, excluding police from the those who appoint the police, the review board. Wimmer argued that the upgrade proposed by Kanal would interfere with the Portland Police Association's collective bargaining rights. Wimmer also announced support for the coalition of city worker unions, including the Portland Police Association, to be held harmless from budget cuts. Finally, Wimmer passed a motion through the Northwest Oregon Labor Council's executive board to admit the Portland Police Association as a member of the council. These moves provoked a backlash from a number of unions, which will be challenging the decision at the Northwest Oregon Labor Council Delegate Assembly on April 28th. What are your thoughts about what's happening there?
I guess the first thing to say is that it's a mistake to conflate the bargaining rights of the police with the bargaining rights of any other group of workers. And that gets back to the thing I was saying earlier about the role of the police in society and them being part of really the disciplinary apparatus of capitalism. The part of their job is to control the working class. And what that means is that their demands have to just be treated separately than the demands of the legitimate labor movement. When the labor movement identifies the two, it it makes a mistake that ultimately comes at its own expense. And in practice, the police always get a special deal in bargaining. They always get, you know, better wages, better pensions. The ruling class understands very well that they have to be treated as this in this exceptional category, and they just always are. For the labor movement to not recognize the difference is ultimately self-defeating, and it will mean that the portion of the city budget that goes to the coercive apparatus will tend to grow, while the rest of us deal with austerity.
Now, those in the local labor, Portland area labor movement who support including the Portland Police Association say that the new Portland Police Association president, Aaron Schmaus, is a good guy, unlike former Portland Police Association presidents, and that the labor movement can have more influence on taming the Portland Police Association if they are inside the House of Labor. What's your thoughts? What are your thoughts about that?
I mean, I think well, there are a couple things to say about that. One is, I think it's naive to think that the labor movement could exercise influence on the police association that would sort of bring the police under control when the whole institutional framework is set up to protect their autonomy. And that, you know, we've seen that their own commanding officers, numerous review boards, the Department of Justice, court orders have not been able to, you know, really bring the police into any sort of real discipline. I think it's doubtful that the peer pressure of other unions would have much of an effect. Secondly, I don't know the PPA president. I've also heard that he's a good guy, but it's not really about individuals. I mean, I'm sure most cops like love their families, they're good neighbors, that sort of thing. But the institution that they're part of has a particular role in society, and to the degree that they participate in it, they serve that function. So the personalities involved are really less important than the place of the institution in the operation of capitalism. Thirdly, I would say, you know, Maya Angelou says that when people tell you who they are, you should believe them. And about 10 years ago, the Portland Police Association told us that they were all Chris Humphreys. Chris Humphreys was one of the cops who beat James Chassie to death, James Chassie being a sort of figure of downtown Portland who lived in poverty his whole life, suffered from mental illness, and the police decided that he was being weird, like, literally not even accused of a crime, and they chased him and he ran and they beat him to death. A few years later, Humphreys was suspended by Police Commissioner Dan Saltzman after he fired a less lethal shotgun at a 12-year-old girl on the Max. And the police association took umbrage to his suspension. They again organized a vote of no confidence. They had a demonstration where they marched to City Hall, and they all carried signs saying, "I am Chris Humphreys." So by their own admission, we should judge them as we would judge him. So I think the third point to make is that I think the proper approach to the police association from the rest of the labor movement is not a strategy of kind of cozying up to them and trying to influence them with soft power, but instead what in European politics is called the cordon sanitaire, which is a principle that parliamentary parties take that they will not coalition with fascist parties. And even conservative parties who, you know, have the plurality of votes but don't have a majority will not coalition with the fascists because their politics are too toxic to become associated with. And I think the labor movement should take that same sort of approach to the police union, which is, at the end of the day, a white supremacist organization.
So who are the local groups organizing to diminish the power of the Portland Police Association? And what is your advice to those in the local labor movement that are trying to halt and reverse the encroachment of the PPA?
I mean, the most notable local organization, the one of longest standing, is Portland Cop Watch, which has been at this for 30 years and tirelessly has documented, you know, all of the various policy changes and political maneuverings of the police during that time. I understand the Democratic Socialists of America have taken an interest in the issue. And the, you know, the labor movement has had a role in this on and off for decades. I mean, in the 90s, organizations like VOLS and the Workers Organizing Committee were working with day laborers, and part of that work involved trying to keep the police out of immigration enforcement. In the early aughts, as I mentioned, after the Carpenters Union was hassled by the Joint Terrorism Task Force, there was a major union rejection of the city's participation in that group. You know, as recently as 2020, like, there were labor contingents at the demonstrations after the murder of George Floyd. I remember seeing social workers in my union handing out shields. As for what they should be doing now in terms of the PPA and the Central Labor Council, I mean, urging their representatives on the Central Labor Council to reject this. And I think, again, maintaining the cordon sanitaire, that if the police association joins the Central Labor Council, other unions should leave.
Great. Well, thank you so much, Christian Williams, for your contribution to this discussion.